איתנו היום, ולא רק רשת, בראד גרינברג, מאמן מכבי אשדוד ועוזר מאמן נבחרת קנדה בכדורסל. לבראד גרינברג גם קריירת NBA מפוארת, בין השאר שימש כמנכ"ל הפילדלפיה 76ers ובחר את אלן אייברסון בדראפט של 1996. איתי סימי ריגר ואני יניר רובינשטיין. הרעיון יתפרס על פני שני חלקים. נצא לדרך. יש לנו פה אורח מיוחד היום, בראד גרינברג, המאמן של מכבי אשדוד, ואנחנו נעבור לאנגלית, נכון סימי?
כן, שאני אבין.
שאתה תבין.
כן.
בראד, thanks for coming all the way down here from אשדוד.
My pleasure, I mean, so look at this, you got a fancy machine here, everything.
Exactly.
This guy's a pro.
This is, I get a chance to spend an evening with Simi, come on. I don't get to see him too much other than when I watch him on TV or
That's a frightening thought. That's a frightening thought.
It's good to see him with all his Israeli basketball history, you know. So, I appreciate that he's a guy who knows Israeli basketball like very few.
So let me ask you something.
Go ahead. I was on the phone with Brad now because he was late to get here to the studio and he told me he's meeting with Rick Pitino. And Simi said, you know, who do you prefer, Brad Greenberg or Rick Pitino? I said, of course, Brad Greenberg.
So do I.
Except he's in the Hall of Fame.
So
and I'm
what?
In the Hall of Shame, you know?
But you're not there yet.
But you didn't cheat. Go ahead.
Rick and I go way, way back. I mean, he's a Long Island guy, and we used to play a lot of pickup basketball in the summertime at a lot of places. I mean, he reminded me that because as we were sitting down, he said, I asked him how his wife Joanne was, and he said, you know, I told her I was going to meet you today, and she said, where, Prospect Park? That was the playground where we used to meet and play once a week. We go way back.
So
way
be
back.
Honest, who would have won in those pickup games?
You know, Rick was a little older and a little more maniacal than I was probably as a player, but we used to play a lot of ball, and we used to play, we would always work in the summer times at the five-star basketball camp, which Simi knows. So we played against each other a lot of counselor games in the evenings, you know, when the campers had to go to sleep and we had a chance to play.
Sure.
No, Rick was a good player. It's hard to imagine. We're talking 40, 45 years.
Yeah, well, he was assistant coach to Ubi with the Knicks.
Yeah, that was, you know. That
years
was,
later.
Yeah.
So let me fast backwards to the 90s and you're in the NBA in various roles, like the phone call you get from the owner, I want you to be the general manager. How does that
that was wild. I had been in Portland for six seasons as a player personnel guy, you know, changed titles from director to a VP at one point, but it was the same job. And then the GM job in Portland opened up and I was the interim GM, but they hired a guy named Bob Whitson, who had been in Seattle. He wasn't too interested in having a, quote, number two guy like me. You know, he was the number one guy, and he didn't want anybody else. So I had another year of a contract, and at the end of that year, the contract wasn't extended. So I was a free agent, really, you know, looking for my next gig. And the Sixers went through an ownership change. Harold Katz sold the team to a partnership between Comcast, the Roberts family, and Spectacor, which was Ed Snyder, who owned the Flyers. And they put a guy named Pat Croce in as the president, and he sort of helped broker the deal. And, you know, I tried to get involved in the job and had some Philadelphia connections between Jimmy Lynam and John Nash, guys that worked in the NBA in different roles. And I had a chance with the interview process. I went there once, and then they asked me to come back a second time.
What are they asking these kind of interviews?
you know, it's a range of things. I mean, basically, you know, how do you build a team? Who would you draft this year in the draft? It was going to be a great draft. I think it was.
We're going to talk about that. Yeah.
You know, just kind of basketball philosophy, really get to know you kind of stuff. So I went back for a second interview, knowing that this was, you know, this was pretty important. And I thought it went well. I wasn't really sure, to be honest with you. Left the interview, went to the hotel right across the street from where the meeting was held, packed up my bags and was going to take a train to Princeton to see, at that time, my brother and sister-in-law, you know, because I was in the East Coast instead of Portland. And literally when I went to check out to the Rittenhouse Hotel, the person at the front desk said, well, we've got a phone call from you. They want you to stick around and I'm going to put someone on the phone. And they put me on the phone, and the next thing another guy said, well, don't leave. We want to have a press conference. We want to offer you a job. So that was exciting, you know. Ironically, I don't know if ironically is the best word, it was the one job that I had in basketball that I didn't really enjoy. I thought it was my goal, you know, to do that, but it turned out that it was much more stressful, just wasn't what I thought it would be, getting to that position. So that was sort of, be careful what you wish for sometimes. You know, I thought it would be, hey, this is it. And it turned out to be a tough, tough year.
Talking about that, how much pressure is it to have the number one pick? You know, you need to make that choice.
You know, that, I didn't feel pressure with that. A basketball decision like that was, you know, was in my wheelhouse. I felt that, you know, that was okay. But dealing with losses, you know, a lot of them, you know, a young team, probably the youngest starting backcourt at that time in the history of the NBA, Jerry Stackhouse, who was an early entry, and Iverson, who was an early entry, they were the young backcourt. Now, his backcourt's younger than that places. But, you know, just dealing with losses, a lot of them in a tough city like Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
And dealing with a very aggressive team president who was promising a parade, like a championship team.
Who was the president?
A fellow named Pat Croce, who was, you know, a very aggressive, very enthusiastic guy who, you know, was a marketing genius.
Did he know anything about basketball?
No, nothing. But, you know, listened to everybody in the world, you know, so he always would have, like, secondhand opinions about things. But, you know, look, he gave me an opportunity. It didn't work out. And I realized that that maybe wasn't the best kind of role for me in pro basketball. A player personnel guy was more up my alley to evaluate players and not be dealing with, with, you know, day-to-day management of the whole operation.
Sure, sure. But how do you approach making that number one pick? I mean, that year was sensational, right? Kobe Bryant out there, Nash.
Yeah, it turned out to be an amazing draft.
Allen. What's your day-to-day work? Like, how do you come to the office? What do you do?
I mean, well, I had gotten the job after the season. You know, it wasn't like there was a lot of ramp-up before the draft, but there was, you know, the college season had already been over.
Yeah.
But the club had drafted Stackhouse the year before, so they had a big guard. The club had Derek Coleman, who was a power forward. The club had Clarence Weatherspoon, who was another forward. Sort of a hybrid forward, but, you know, had to play as like a three, even if he wasn't your classic small forward. So really there were two big gaps on that roster. One would be a big player or a dynamic, you know, guard with the ball. And Iverson was, in my mind, the best guard who could change things. You know, be an exciting player, enthusiastic player. Yeah. A guy that could, you know, inject something really special. Or a big guy, and the best big guy was Marcus Camby. Uh-huh. He was the one center who I didn't think was the same caliber as a guy like Iverson. So really, it just came down to, you know, I thought, who was the toughest guy to guard that was in the draft? And I thought it was Iverson.
Yeah.
Who was the fastest, quickest, most exciting guy in the draft? And I thought it was Iverson. And he was at a position of need. If you could turn the clock back now, you certainly could make arguments that maybe someone could have said, well, who has the most potential? And someone could have maybe said Kobe Bryant, if you believed in that. But he was just a high school kid.
Right.
And I didn't have the nerve to think about drafting him number one. He was special. And we worked him out, and he had an amazing workout. You know, and you just left the gym going, wow, this is a
And Calipari told me he worked him out, too, when he was with the Nets.
Yeah.
And they wanted to take him.
They did.
And the GM didn't have the balls to do it.
Well,
so they took... The
Kerry
guy from Kerry Kittles, yeah.
Well, to Calipari's, or the GM, I should say, John Nash's credit, who was the GM, they got very, very, very strong signals before the draft from Wasserman Media Group. Arne Tellem was the head of that, that, you know, he was going to be a problem to keep, because Arne knew that Jerry West wanted to figure out a way to get him. They wanted
Kobe.
Yeah, they wanted him in L.A. The agent wanted him in L.A. So they were sending strong messages, you know, don't draft him.
So
don't draft him.
So when we hear these strong messages, that means someone gives you a call?
You know, I don't know exactly how that was relayed, but I think that Arne was, you know, lived in L.A. Arne had a very good relationship with Jerry West, knew that the Lakers were going to try like crazy to figure out a trade somehow, which they ended up doing, Vlade Divac to Charlotte. Charlotte's pick was to get Kobe and flip that. So then I'm sure that, you know, Arne basically, you know, lobbied hard with New Jersey to say, you know, you don't want to do this. It'll be a problem. The kid doesn't want to play in New Jersey. You know, how it exactly went down, I don't know. But the message was strong enough for New Jersey to get cold feet, you know, and draft Kobe. And the rest is history.
So you mentioned, you know, at the end of the year you were fired. I mean, do you feel like front office executives have a little bit more of a leash nowadays?
Yeah, I think so. I think my situation in Philly was unique in that the president of the club, Pat Croce, was, you know, charged with running the team. And he was very aggressive in trying to market the team and probably oversold what the club could accomplish in year one of a new regime. You know, we improved, I think, by like 4 games from the previous year, but that wasn't very significant. And I think that he felt, you know what, this wasn't good enough, and I've got to blow it up and get somebody in here to run the team and coach it that, you know, just makes a bigger splash. And they were able to get Larry Brown, which satisfied, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, what he was trying to do. And Larry had success. They continued to build the roster. I think I left them in very good financial shape as far as roster management to be able to make some moves and change the roster. And, you know, 3 or 4 years later, they were in the finals.
You've really been to, you know, places like Philadelphia 76ers and Knicks and so on. But regarding that championship with Maccabi Haifa, right, do you view that year, that championship, as one of kind of the high moments of your career, even though, you know, it's a completely different setting, but in some sense it is a fairy tale?
Yeah, I've been lucky, really lucky, to have had, you know, some cool moments, different levels, wearing different hats. But that Haifa year was magical, and I didn't really appreciate it until later on when I realized what it meant to other people.
Right.
To me, it was like, you know, really cool. You know, we won the championship after having lost a whole bunch of times to Maccabi Tel Aviv during the regular season. So it was kind of a little bit of a surprise to everybody that we could beat them finally. I didn't realize, you know, how significant it was for first championship that Haifa had ever had.
Sure.
And I didn't realize until I saw what it meant to, like, the Israeli players. I don't think the import players, you know, the Americans could really appreciate what
That's
it meant.
Right.
And so it was pretty special. So I, after the fact, I realized this is really neat. And I kind of remembered that when I coached one summer the Kosovo national team. And we advanced in the qualifications for, I guess it was, the World Championships, and what it meant for the Kosovo players and,
sure,
and Federation. Like, wait a minute, they never won a game in FIBA competition. And all of a sudden we had won a couple of games and now we were going to play in the next round, which was like a big, big, big thing. So I could appreciate that more, knowing what it meant to, like, people in Kosovo, that their team had actually won some games and was advancing, which it reminded me of the Haifa thing a little bit. So.
Yeah.
It's cool. And then, you know, I was lucky enough once in college to get to, as a head coach, to get to the NCAA tournament, which was a neat accomplishment. But,
well, who was that with, Ratcher?
Yeah.
You had the big kid.
I had Art Parakowski.
Yeah, Parakowski, right.
Made me look like a good coach because he was the best player in the league for 2 seasons. And one of those years, we got to the NCAA tournament. I always told people we tied for second. We lost to Carolina in the first round. and they won the national championship. So it was like, okay, we were second. Everybody else lost to them also. What the heck?
Yeah, right. Well, one of the things I have to say is you were able, or you did, I don't know if you were able family-wise, to fly all over the world. Well, I had chances to coach in different places, but because of my family situation, I couldn't do it. You know, I brought up three kids by myself and all kinds of things. Like Jimmy offered me a job when he just got the Carolina state job to be his assistant coach. And my wife refused to come because she says there are no Jews in Raleigh, North Carolina. Well, what's the matter with you? If there's money there, there are Jews there. You know, well, what the hell's going on? You know, and things like that, or Spain, you know. How did you manage
it? It wasn't always easy, and I can't say that I expected to be doing it for, this is my ninth season coaching out of the country, out of the U.S. And I'm lucky. I wasn't married during the early times that I was coaching internationally, but I was in a relationship, you know, luckily with a very independent woman who, you know, was very comfortable and didn't need to, you know, to be codependent on anybody, was very successful in her own right. And now it's gotten a little bit more difficult, I have to admit, because at my age, you know, you start thinking about, you know, how many years do you want to spend without being a partner to somebody else and having, you know, a life with somebody
else. Not just
else,
that, years, years you can really enjoy it with her.
Yeah.
That's important.
And it's a, you know, it's a solitary life that I live for a good portion of the year.
Yeah.
Especially when you're struggling. When your team's winning, it's not that bad.
Good.
But when your team is struggling like we are right now, it's, you'd like to be able to go home to somebody, you know, that makes the rest of the time a little more enjoyable than, you know.
Yeah,
but you're wondering whether I'll be able to turn the TV on and listen to Simi Rieger talking about an NBA game.
Yeah, but you see, you're lucky. You would have had somebody that would have been with you. My first wife bothered me even more. So me coming home was a horror show, except for the kids, you know, really.
So regarding that championship with Maccabi Haifa, right? I spoke to Nick Nurse last year, and he was particularly proud about his two G League championships, you know, because a champion is a champion. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly remember fondly the players that you're involved with when you have success that ends in a championship like that. I mean, yeah, those years stand out a little bit more, championship seasons, but I also get great satisfaction out of a number of teams that I was involved with that didn't necessarily win championships, but you knew they played good basketball.
Like overachieved.
Or just, you know, came close to their capacity.
Right.
Like the year I had in Jerusalem was unbelievable to me. Like great players, great people. We had success in the Euro Cup, got to the final eight, I guess.
Like your big man got hurt.
And we had injuries in the playoffs, and, you know, we couldn't finish the season the way we might have. But that doesn't take away from the fact that, you know, coaching guys like Bracy Wright and Derwin Kitchen and Ron Dupree and Yotam Halperin and Yaniv Green, and it was wonderful. Art Parakowski, I mean, that team played really pretty basketball. They were unselfish.
Yep,
and I feel great about that year, even though it didn't end the way you wanted it to. It was a disappointment to some, but it wasn't to me. You know, it was a year of great success. But, you know, yeah, we didn't win a championship. You know, it happens.
Sometimes teams do better that you don't like because of the players that you have that aren't close-knit or whatever it is, and players that, like he said, almost came close to their, you know, ability. You know, I there are a couple of teams that did well for me. I couldn't stand some of the players, and they weren't good within themselves. And then there's some teams that really mesh together. A lot of it depends on who the captain is and how he sets the tone. You know, that's a very important thing. Who's strong in the locker room?
The phrase I would use is that the team was connected. And if you don't have a connected team, you know, guys that want to make the extra pass, that want to help each other on defense, you know, you're not going to have the kind of success you hope to have. I was talking about that with my team today, that, you know, we have to be more connected. We have to be willing to help each other a little bit more, move the ball a little bit better, and find an open guy, and help each other more on defense. You know, there's a book, I think it's called The Basketball Book. Bill Simmons wrote it.
Yeah.
And I think one of the first chapters is describing a conversation with Isaiah Thomas, where Thomas describes the secret of those Detroit Pistons championship teams. And it's all about being connected. It's about how the only thing that counted for any of them was to win. And they were all willing to sacrifice individual stuff to have a chance to win a championship.
Well, now, a lot of times you have to build a team like that. That's what a lot of coaches don't understand, and basketball people don't understand. You can't have five superstars on the team. You need maximum two guys that are really, really good. And the rest have to be complementary players.
זה היה החלק הראשון מתוך שניים של לא רק רשת. בו ערכנו את ברד גרינברג, איתי סימי ריגר ואני יניר רובינשטיין. החלק השני של הרעיון בפרק הבא.